G'day everybody, I'm Glenn Hill.
And I'm Jacob Meyer.
And welcome to the Tactical Tennis Podcast, the post-Australian Open Men's Final Edition.
It's time for some actual analysis.
Right, so a couple of days ago we had previewed the men's final. We had a look at the men's semis and then previewed the men's final a bit. And I do just want to open up the podcast by saying that while you, Jacob, might have predicted Nadal to win in four.
Wait, come on. Here I was going to be a nice guy and give you props for calling this one correctly.
Well, I'm giving myself props.
Start us out like that.
I didn't want to take the chance, you know, that it was going to be left unsaid. But I will say that I was slightly wrong in that I had predicted Federer to win in four sets, and he did take the extra set to do it. But that Roger Federer, five-set victory over Rafael Nadal to take his 18th Grand Slam. And, I mean, I think he, in a sense, couldn't have done it in more emphatic fashion.
Well, I don't know about that. 6-4, 3-6, 6-1, 3-6, 6-3. Not the scoreline that we're used to seeing from these guys over the years.
Well, sure. But, in a sense, I think this was more of a statement win than if Federer had come out and just blown Nadal off the court. Because if he'd done that, you know, everyone might just say, well, Nadal had a bad day or Federer just played out of his mind. And instead, what we saw was a very human Roger Federer play some amazing tennis, have some pretty easy misses, and ultimately come up with the goods at the end of the match in the fifth set against Rafael Nadal. I mean, this has been the match of his nightmares for the past 8 years. Going back to, you know, the infamous 2009 Australian Open final he played against Nadal, where, you know, he broke down in tears in the middle of the trophy ceremony. You know, this is his nightmare, playing Nadal in a Grand Slam final and it going five. He's never done this before.
You know,
a lot of people said he couldn't do it, and here he is.
I think it's just Melbourne that makes the guys cry, you know. I think just because they love the Aussie so much.
Yeah, maybe. You know, there seem to be a lot of crying at the Australian Open.
I mean, a lot of guys have cried at the hand of both of these men.
Well, that's
but
true.
To be fair, the one thing that I want to really point out at the start is, you know, a lot of people, like, there's obviously a lot of Roger Federer fans.
Really?
And both of us.
Is he
popular? We're both Roger Federer fans, just, you know, cards on the table. But from all the other coaches that I talked to, from all the guys, you know, I mean, we talk about this kind of stuff in the locker room and in the cafeteria and stuff when you're hanging out in Melbourne. And most people that were picking Roger seem to really just pick it based on emotions.
Nostalgia,
you know?
Really.
They wanted it more than they believed it was going to happen.
Right.
You know?
And look, I do want to point out that, yes, we are both Roger Federer fans, but you have always been a little more of a rougher guy.
No, I completely disagree with that. Mm. I have – look, when it comes to picking Rafa against Roger, I mean, I went for history here. You know.
No, but I'm just saying going back 5 years, like, you've always been, I think, a little more of a Rafa fan than a Roger fan. In terms of, especially when we've had that whole greatest of all time argument, which is obviously an ongoing discussion.
He's got the head to head. I'm just telling you that you might see me as being that way. It's more about cheering for the underdog and having respect for how Rafa has changed his game and adapted.
Changed tennis, really, if we're going to be
honest
about it.
Yeah, and he's adapted, you know, because over the years, I mean, the first time I saw him, I think he was still, it was right before he turned 17, playing like qualies at the Miami Open.
Right.
But no, I mean, to be fair, like, you know the style of game that I play, you know the things that I've worked on in my own life and the things that I really enjoy. That kind of stuff is all encapsulated by the Federer mystique. Like, I'm not that much of a Rafa guy. I mean, you can't get me to hit 12 balls in a row and a point if you pay me.
Well, sure. No, I get that. But I'm just saying, from the other perspective, it always seemed to me that you were a little more pro-Rafa than pro-Roger. But point being, you were saying that a lot of people were really picking Roger to win the tournament, not really because of the result of any actual tactical analysis.
Yeah,
it wasn't a clinical observation. There was a lot of nostalgia, a lot of just the fact that everybody likes the guy so gosh darn much. Not to say that Nadal isn't popular, obviously. Very lovable fella. But, yeah,
no,
obviously Roger's Roger.
People, A lot of people picked Rafa as well, and you ask them why, and they just said, well, you know, because he's better, or because I want him to win, or because he's got Fed's number. And, you know, it wasn't much of reason. I mean,
But I think those aren't reasons. I think they're fair reasons. When you look at the history, the clear edge that Nadal has, and especially has had in the last 8-9 years since, you know, Federer's peak. And I mean, obviously he's not the peak player that he was, not the player that he was in his peak, but I mean, the fall wasn't that far compared to a lot of other people. But in the last 8 years, Rafa's had his number. He's dominated the head-to-head. Roger hasn't beaten Rafa at a Grand Slam since, I think, was it 2008?
Or 9.
2008,
yeah.
I believe.
8 or 9.
Yeah, is the last time he beat Rafa. It's been a very long time. So I think it's very fair for somebody to say, I pick Rafa because I think he's just better, or just off that gut feeling, because there's a history there that makes it stand up.
I mean, that's fine, because history backs you up. The bottom line is it's not taking account of everything. And so where I give you credit is in recognizing the things that Federer's been doing differently, and in recognizing the game plan that he's going out there with. And even though we didn't talk about it that much on the podcast, we've mentioned it off air to each other about how, you know, Federer's been working really hard for 6 months. He's never taken this kind of time away from the game. And just having a good, solid psychological understanding of what, you know, how the guy ticks and what goes on in between his ears, understanding that he was going to come out and he was going to stay committed. And sure, there would be nervy movements. And sure, you know, he's going to make a lot of errors, but that he had a real understanding of what he needed to do, and that he'd have the commitment to follow that through.
There was question about that. I mean, I questioned that, and I'm the guy who picked him to win.
He's never done it.
Well, sure, I know, but I'm saying, like, that was a real question. I had the sense that he was going to step up, and like I said last time, you know, I think there's been many a time when he's essentially chickened out, you know, and as I said, like, for all the great matches that they've had, in every single one of them, Rafa's done his part to make it a great match. Federer's done his part sometimes, but like I said, there's always been that sense that, you know, in the big moment against Rafa, he has shied away from doing what he needed to do to really win. He's been conservative, and he's paid the price for that time and time again. And it's always been a source of deep frustration for me watching that process happen and feeling like if only he would kind of learn from history, if only he would do something different. There's that old adage of the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. And for Roger, chipping the backhand return, trying to play the extended rallies with Nadal, I mean, that was the insanity that we kept seeing for a very long time. And look, sanity has arrived. I mean, let's talk about the match. Let's talk about what Roger did, which was he talked about this in his post-match press conference, was that he went out there with the intent of stepping up into the court and taking the ball earlier and really putting some pressure on Rafa in a sustained way that I think he hasn't really done in a long time.
He pressed. You know, he ran around returns. He hit the backhand return bigger. He went for it. You know,
he went
loses.
Over it. I mean, that's I think step number one is, you know, he had a long history of chipping that return, and today, tonight, last night, we saw him consistently hit over the return and not just over attack it.
That's what I think is the big difference, because there have been times where he's hit over it in the past, but he didn't do enough with it and wasn't aggressive enough with it. And especially if you rewind, you know, 8 years to when Roger probably decided in his own psyche hitting over the return isn't effective against this guy. You know, Rafa was pummeling forehands at that point. So, you know, what he did was he created opportunity for himself so that if he connects on one or two, and or if Rafa makes a slightly softer mistake than what we would normally see from him, all of a sudden he's got an opening in the game and he's getting break points.
Right, and he got break points. I mean, he got break points consistently through most of the match, barring, you know, that one rough set.
But, I mean, he had 20 break points throughout five sets.
Which is, yeah, obviously that's a very large number. And one of the things I think that stands out to me about that as well was, in the past we've seen Roger get a lot of break points on Rafa and fail to convert, largely through passive play. And this match, even though Rafa saved a lot of break points, what were the numbers on the break point saves? Do you have that handy?
Yeah, Fed had 20 break point opportunities and he won six.
Right?
Yeah.
Which is that's a pretty poor conversion rate. But when we watch the actual match,
but it's Rafa.
Well, but it's not just that it was Rafa. Like I said, in the past, he always did a good job of creating break point opportunities. And that's part of the heartbreak of watching this matchup happen was he'd earn the break point, play a passive point on the break point, and watch it slip away. But we saw something different here, where on those break points, Rafa stepped up and came up huge time and time again. Obviously, not six times he didn't come up huge, but he certainly tried to. You know, I mean, we just saw so many times when Rafa actually, like, took that break point and earned it back. You know, it wasn't just, you know, Fed kind of passively letting Rafa kind of take, you know, Fed puts a passive return in play and then Rafa just dictates play with his forehand and then inevitably Fed makes the backhand error and we say, well, we saw that coming a mile away. It was Rafa really making stuff happen, playing very proactive tennis, being more aggressive. He hit some aces. I mean, he just played some real... I think some of his best tennis on the night was on his break points, and yet Fed still broke him six times.
Yeah, I think that on half the points where, you know, besides the six that Fed actually converted, on half of the leftover break points, Rafa was either hitting an unreturnable serve or a winner.
Right.
And, you know, that's really disheartening when you're on the other side of the net and you have a break point and then the guy just raises it to a level where there's nothing you can do.
Right. No, absolutely. But, I you know, and we saw the flip side of that because, I mean, for all that Fed only converted 6 of 20 break points, Rafa only took 4 of 17. 24% conversion rate, which for him is very low. And the same story. We saw Federer hitting aces. We saw him hitting forehand winners. We saw him he hit 73 winners in this match in five sets. You know, that's a lot of winners, and a lot of them came off big points.
And it's a lot for Fed, and it's a lot against Rafa. Rafa doesn't give up winners like that.
No, not at all. You know, and you know, this is in a lot of ways, there's a lot of similarities between this match and the semifinal that Nadal played against Dimitrov in that, you know, like Dimitrov, Federer was the driver in this match. He was the one who, by and large, forced things to happen. You know, we saw that with the Dimitrov match where Dimitrov had far more winners than Nadal, also far more unforced errors than Nadal. Dimitrov had more net approaches. I mean, Dimitrov was the driving force. And we see that again here with Federer. You know, 73 winners and 57 unforced errors. To Nadal's 35-28. Same thing on the net points. You know, Fed came in 40 times, winning 29 of them, 73%. Those are great numbers. Nadal, 10 of 12. But this is the other interesting thing to me is Nadal, we've seen him be more aggressive all tournament long, looking to come forward, you know, taking the ball a little bit close to the baseline, really actively coming forward, shortening points. Against Dimitrov, we saw him come in, what, 20 times, was it? And against Fed, he only manages 12, which...
Big difference. I'm not so sure that Rafa believed that Federer would commit to doing what he did. I think, like, I got the sense almost, especially in the fifth, that Rafa was waiting a little bit. Like, we're going to go back to our pattern. I'm going to spin the ball high up to your backhand. You're going to hit 3 or 4 or 5, but you're going to struggle with it. And then, like, I'm going to beat you.
And really, that was the backhand is probably the biggest story of the day because, I mean, for all that Federer served well, you know, and I think came up with some great serves on big points, it wasn't his best serving day, but by God, can you remember a time that he ever hit the backhand better than this against Rafa?
Against Rafa? No, there's no way.
No way. I mean,
just no way.
I think the amazing stat to me is, you know, I mean, we're watching, and the fourth set, it really, I sense like the match was slipping away from Fed. You know, it really felt to me like he'd had his moment, and the moment had passed him by, and he just seemed to be fading. And he looked a little tired, he looked a little sloppy, a little fatigued. The fifth set starts, and obviously gives up that break right away, and just reinforces that sense of, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah, well, I mean, he lost the set. You know, I mean, he wins the third, but then he goes down 6-3, what, 3-1?
Yeah, well, yeah, but he gives up the break right away. But here's where it gets really fascinating to me is, in the fifth set, that time when we've traditionally seen Federer wilt and fade against Nadal, just, you know, you just see him get tired. You see that backhand get tired. Roger hit 8 backhand winners in the last set, in the fifth set. He hit more backhand winners in that one fifth set than he hit in the 4 sets before it. And they weren't just, you know, like easy put away backhands. He was cracking cross court backhand winners into Nadal's forehand in the middle of baseline rallies.
And can we talk about that? Can we talk about just the cross court ball? Because even just look at match point. Even if you didn't get to watch the match, what does he do on match point? He hits a cross-court forehand winner.
Right.
And you've written about this, and we've talked about it not ad nauseum because it's actually an interesting topic for us, but we've talked about it plenty, where Roger stopped hitting truly cross-court balls, instead hitting balls that are kind of cross-court but really are just deep through the baseline.
Sure.
But not hitting the cross court ball.
Yeah, I mean, he certainly hasn't been opening
somebody outside the alley.
Yeah, he has not been opening the court up. I mean, he opens the court up beautifully with his serve.
Yes.
Probably better than ever. However, but he hasn't been opening the court up during the middle of baseline rallies the way that he was, you know, during those prime years of 2004, 5, 6. You know, you can argue maybe 2008 or 2007, of course, too. But, you know, there's that argument about exactly when did things start to slip a little bit. But regardless, I mean, back then, you know, we saw him in angled forehands in the middle of baseline rallies that were just insane at the time. And backhands, too. And then, obviously we've seen some of that disappear. And, you know, I will say some of that, I think, comes down to that commitment he's had over the last few years of really trying to press forward. And there's that idea, look, the more that I angle the ball, the harder it kind of is for me to come forward now because I've opened the court up for my opponent. Mm. If I narrow the court, when I come forward, it creates or makes it harder for them to create angles to pass me with. So I don't know how much of that is intent.
Do you really think that that's how it happened? I mean, that's very logical, and it certainly makes sense. But do you think that that's actually the order of operations that went down in Federer's head?
This is without sitting down and having a conversation with the man, which, you know, obviously I would dearly love to do. It becomes a chicken-egg argument, you know. Was this a part of a cohesive strategy on Federer's part? I don't know. We've seen the man play consistently with very intelligent patterns for a very long time. We've seen very intentful adaptations in his game in terms of his commitment to moving forward and shortening points. I'm not going to sit here and say that, you know, he definitely planned that out. I'm also not willing to say that he didn't plan it out.
Okay. Well, just like you made the call boldly about not just that Federer would win this match, but how he was going to win this match, and you're off by a set, but you nailed it, okay? I will sit here and make that call that I don't buy it for a second that that's the way that Roger's career has gone down, that he made a conscious decision.
Right.
If nothing else, he came forward more when he was younger. He was serving and volleying all the time.
Well, come on. Okay, so I will grant you he won a Wimbledon title serve and volleying, which I don't think there's anybody remaining on tour who obviously you can say that. But I don't think that's entirely true. I mean, I think we've seen multiple phases of Federer's career. So we have those earlier days when I think he served volleyed more and came for quite a lot. And then we have a middle period. You know, I would probably go back to like 2007, maybe through 2010, maybe 11, where he stopped coming forward as much. Mm-hmm. And then when he started working with Anacombe, we see that resurgence, that commitment to moving forward. You know, and Edberg also had some influence on him in that. Where, you know, that's where we started to see the quote-unquote saber, the sneak attack by Roger.
To be fair, Anacone suggested to him to move forward more and suggested to him to do more of what he did when he was younger. But Roger didn't do very much of it. Then, after Paul left and Edberg came in, and Edberg was saying the same things that Paul Anacone was saying, that's when he started to do it.
Regardless of and that's fair enough. My point is simply that, obviously, I think he has, you know, over the last few years, been moving forward a lot more than he was for the period before that. We could argue about the degree to which he surveyed and came forward, you know, just, in the early years, you know, when he was.
He's definitely
everybody.
Moving forward now. The question is, what contributed to that? And I'm just saying that I think he just realized how good he was from the baseline. And when he was hitting those cross-court forehands and taking the ball off the court all the time, he's doing with his ground strokes what other people can only do with their serves, opening the court up.
Well, most other people, right? I mean, obviously, I think Rafa could open the court up that way. We see Djokovic do it when somebody gives him a little angle to work with. But point being, I get what you're saying. Like, there's been obviously a fundamental change in the way he's constructed points off the ground over the last – I mean, heck, we've seen this change happen and occur over a 10-year period now. But point being, regardless of whether or not we agree about the motivation, he is opening the court up more in a way that we haven't seen. And to me, I think what's important is the pace. He's opening up the court with – I shouldn't even say opening up the court. What he is doing is just slapping cross-court winners on people.
No, he is
I don't
opening
say slap.
Just
I don't
some
say
of
slap,
them are winners. Some of them are
yeah,
winners.
Yeah, well, a lot of them are winners. A lot of them are not coming back. But you know, but this obviously was a huge, huge part of this match. But the backhand and his willingness to step in and really drive through the ball and attack the ball and hit it cross court with conviction, and really the lack of fear that he showed of Nadal's forehand as a whole, I think we saw some nervous backhands there, especially a couple that he pushed long, and you could see that kind of deceleration on that stroke where it was like, I'm going to hit this down line, but I don't want to miss it, but I don't want, you know, Rafa to get a forehand. And,
so.
But by and large, the fear was gone. You know, he attacked Rafa's forehand. He attacked it with his own forehand. He attacked it with his backhand. I think he used the fact that Rafa was always looking to run around his backhand against him and made him pay.
So the next question is, do you think that this style of play is sustainable for Roger Federer? And can he continue to do this? Or is this just... this is a one-off. I did it in the finals. I got my five. I've set another record.
Well,
I beat Rafa.
He didn't just – like look, to be fair, like, he didn't just do it in the finals. This is we've seen him be doing this for 3 weeks now. We saw it from his first comeback match at the Hopman Cup. We saw it at all the Hopman Cup matches. We've seen it at every stage of this tournament. He has moved up in the court. He's taken the ball earlier. He's consistently been hitting the cross-court winners. He is playing with a sense of purpose – and I think a very clear direction, similar to how we saw him have a very clear sense of purpose with the, I'm trying to think the right word here, the enthusiasm, I guess, with which he was moving forward under Edberg.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where that was, just, it just marked a very clear shift. It was like all of a sudden,
right.
Oh my God, Roger Federer's getting to the net all the time. Like
he's
coming
committed.
Off returns,
yeah.
He's coming, you know. You know, I just see like.
But we don't see the saber very often anymore.
Well, you know, that's just true. But what I'm saying is it's a different – what we're seeing now is a different purpose. We saw that very, I think, clear delineation of that period when all of a sudden it was like Roger's going to come into the net a lot. And
mm-hmm.
and we saw that reap dividends for him. And we saw – I think it helped him net an extra Wimbledon title. I mean, I think that helped – him stay competitive at a period where I think otherwise he was a little bit lost because his ground strokes weren't quite at the level they were, you know, 5 years before. He was serving very well.
Well, now, to be fair, I don't think his ground strokes have slipped at all. If anything, I think they're probably improving.
Right. Well,
but
now
I think
they
that's
are.
Just, I think that's just the tactics that
well,
weren't
but I don't,
at the
I don't,
same
look, level. I don't think you can say that Roger Federer is hitting his forehand as well in 2011 as he was in 2006. I just
don't think?
I don't think you can begin to say that. I think he made far more errors. I think it was not quite the same quality. It was still a very good forehand, don't get me wrong. But I just don't think it was as good as it was in those years when he was dominating the tour.
I just see that as being the tactics. And
I'm gonna tell you this.
I
mean he shortened the backswing some, it lost some of the smoothness. There was a definite shift in the way he went about hitting that ball, and I think the quality of that forehand stroke diminished a little. And I think that's noticeable.
One of the reasons that I picked Rafa for this match and that I felt like, you know, even looking back, I mean, I wouldn't change my pick. I mean, I know why I picked him and I you know, I think it was a smart thing to do, even though it turned out to be wrong, right?
Sure.
Is when I watched Federer at the Hopman Cup this year, I did not see him hitting cross court the way that I saw him specifically against Stan Wawrinka and against Rafa in these two matches here. And that actually is what I looked for, because in order to beat Rafa, I thought he's going to have to hit the cross court forehand. That's the ball that really opens up the court and allows him to do more with the backhand. I saw him, what impressed me was in the match against Stan, he got to hit a lot of cross court backhands that were truly cross court, because that's something that Stan does well. And Stan seemed to be content to kind of hit a lot of balls, which might not be the best strategy against Roger if you're Stan, by the way. But I didn't see him opening the court from the ground in all of those matches leading up to Stan, like we did yesterday.
Sure.
This morning,
but,
whatever.
But the point of me is that you saw, I'm not sure I agree with that 100%. What I did see was him doing it enough that I felt it was an option for him. You know, that it was just a choice of whether or not he wanted to open the court up. It wasn't a question anymore of can he. It was just like, is that the appropriate thing for me to do in this match, in this shot, in this circumstance? But you have made comments for a week now, and we talked about it in the last podcast, about how frequently we're seeing him hit cross-court forehand winners, which is something that hasn't really been featuring strongly for him for quite some time now.
It hasn't been there. And I'll tell you, too, because this matchup is really similar to the one with Rafa and Dimitrov. This is what I think Dimitrov is missing, and this is why I picked Rafa to go ahead of Dimitrov, because I don't think you're going to beat him hitting through the court, as we say, in between the trams. And, you know, it's completely different than, say, if we look at Istomin against Djokovic. Istomin was hitting the ball flat and down the line, and he's finishing points with lasers, and all the big points in that match were determined really by going down the line and beating him through the court. And I still just don't think that when Rafa's playing at this level that that's going to get it done. And
well,
I don't think that's what got it done for Federer.
I think Dimitrov came within one point of getting it done doing it that way. But be that as it may, you asked me whether or not Federer can sustain this and if this is a viable strategy for moving forward. I think the answer to that is clearly a yes. I think that, to my mind, I've seen him playing this way for 3 weeks now. I don't think this is going away. I don't think this is changing. I think, you know, what you attribute to his last two matches with Wawrinka and Nadal, to me, is also just a part of him really returning to kind of peak form for where he's at right now in his career. You know, I mean, after a six-month layoff, I wouldn't expect him to come out and be 100% sharp in those Hopman Cup matches or even the early rounds of this Australian Open. And we did see him drop a couple sets of players or, you know, have some competitive sets of players that maybe shouldn't have been that way. But point being, like, I think we've just seen a very clear strategy from him. He's come out and employed that strategy consistently and gotten better at it as the tournament went on. Will he do this moving forward? He'd be crazy not to. Will we see him doing this, you know, and can he be effective doing this? Look, it's Roger Federer. Of course he can be effective doing this. Whether or not he's going to win more slams doing this is going to depend in part on the tournament organizers. And that brings me to something I really wanted to touch on in this podcast, which is the court surface. We talked about this last time, the variety of tennis that we've seen in this tournament and the contrasts in styles, the way it's allowed players of a very different game styles to be successful. You know, we've seen, you know, grinders be successful. We've seen counterpunch be successful. We've seen serve and volleys be successful. We've seen power play. Everybody has had their moment in the sun this tournament. Every style of tennis has had its moment to shine. I think that it would be crazy if you're organizing, you know, Cincinnati, or it doesn't really matter. If you're organizing any tournament, you have to look at the outcomes here. And the buzz that's been generated around this Australian Open has been phenomenal. And I think you have to recognize that this variety and these new faces and names and people getting in the headlines is healthy for the sport. The way that they've homogenized the court surface over the last 15 years and just made it possible for a certain style of player to dominate and get consistent results has not been the healthiest thing for us as a sport. And I would love to see more tournament organizers speed up the surface like they did at the Australian Open. Not so Federer can win more. I mean, look, I'm super happy he got number 18. I really am. But, you know, I'm just as happy to have seen, like, Misha Zverev serve and volley his way through, you know, to the point where he did and make it like a quarterfinal. I'm just as happy to have seen, you know, Istomin and some of these other players have a great outcome. And be able to play on a surface that actually showcases some of their skills, because there's a heck of a lot more to tennis than running side to side and hitting ground strokes. And I'm just so happy that we've had a tournament that finally, you know, people for the first time in a long time got to truly see that.
Well, I still don't think, I mean, this is going to be an interesting one. I'm going to have to take a little behind the door survey of some of the players that were on the stadium court in Melbourne on Rod Laver Arena. But I don't get the impression that the courts in Australia were as fast as, say, the courts at the U.S. Open.
They're
getting close.
No, I think they were faster than the U.S. Open. I think you could see it. I think you could visibly see it. And Federer even mentioned about the courts in his post, about sometimes just some of the times when he hit the shot and let the court do the work. You saw some of those forehands he hit just fly. I mean, obviously they were hit pretty hard, but even so, yeah. No, but even so, like, I think they were balls that on a different surface, on a different hard court, I would have seen Rafa get rackets on, maybe even return, and here there were winners by 5 feet. You know, where
okay,
Rafa
so
wasn't even getting
this
close.
This is actually something else that I wanted to point out, which I think this is really clear that Rafa is not as fast as he used to be. He's not slow.
I know. But,
but I mean, look at him coming out of corners and changing direction and doing a lot of like the hustle plays, I went back and I looked at 10 years ago and 8 years ago and 12 years ago, and you know, I was still blown away by how fast this guy was.
Right.
I think that that's one place in which his game style has taken a toll, is that I think he's slowed down a little bit.
Right. You know, there was obviously a long silence after you made that statement. And to be honest with you, there was a part of me that was trying to disagree with you, and I just couldn't come up with a cohesive point to do so. You know, I struggle with that, because I saw him make some plays today that just impressed the heck out of me.
He's still super fast.
I'd have to see, honestly, some more play over the next couple of months to really say that with any certainty. My sense just was that the court was a lot faster than we've seen at the Australian Open in probably more than 15 years, and that had a huge...
Oh, I think it's the fastest court we've ever... I mean, the fastest court we've seen there since it was, you know, grass court in Kooyong.
Maybe. You might be right about that. Because, I mean, obviously, Rebound Ace kind of had a funny way of playing where it would change dramatically depending on the temperature and humidity and whatnot. But, I don't know. You know, Nadal looked pretty fast to me. He made some great gets. I just felt like the court really changed the dynamic a lot. And like I said, I would love to see some more speedy courts out there just to provide some more balance to the tour and give us some more contrast. And the degree to which that happens, I think, will depend partly on, or will impact, whether or not Federer can win more slams playing like this.
That's true.
My gut feeling is yes. I mean, I think he can still be a factor.
I think
everywhere except probably Roland Garros. At Roland Garros, I mean, I think he'd have to have a phenomenal 2 weeks to be.
I think if he's hitting cross court like he did in these last two matches, then he's a factor in Paris.
I think he has to have a phenomenal 2 weeks to really be a real factor. I'm not saying he can't do it. But it brings me back a little bit to that conversation about Cilic we had last time. For Cilic to win the U.S. Open, so many things came together. The draw opened up. He just played the best 2 weeks of his life. I feel like a little bit of that has to happen for Fed to win again at Roland Garros, especially with a healthy Nadal in the mix. I'm not saying it's impossible. I just feel like with his movement being a little bit lessened than it used to be, he really has to go out and completely and utterly dictate play. And he has to serve very well for that to have to happen. But again, I mean, the way he hit the backhand over these 2 weeks, you know, I feel like it's a bit tough to bet against him on anything right now, you know?
Yeah, I mean, he's right there. And, you know, let's keep in mind, he really didn't have an easy – I mean, the easy match that he had in this tournament was, you know, what, Misha Zverev in the quarterfinals? That was the only guy, I think, who stepped on the court and thought, you know, I'm – I'm just happy to be here, and I'm probably not going to win.
Sure. Well, but I don't know. Misha probably had that same atmosphere, that same attitude with Murray, and it worked out okay for him then. But let's talk a little bit more about the match. I mean, obviously we've got plenty of time to discuss Fed's future and Nadal's too, for that matter. When you think about that, the five sets, what to you was perhaps the biggest turning point?
Of this match, you mean?
Yeah, because I mean, I certainly know on my end what I felt like was the moment that made the biggest difference for Federer.
To me, you know, this is one of the things that really stood out about the match, and I think it's related to the style of play that Federer brought in, is there were so many important moments that even, you know, I mean, Rafa was up a break in the fifth, and at first he thought, like, oh man, okay, that's going to be hard to overcome. It always is. And it was hard to overcome. Federer had plenty of break points. He got the break back. And then he's, what, 5-3 and love 30?
Right.
For me, at that love 30, where, you know, what I look for as a coach is, okay, now this is what pressure for Roger Federer looks like, because he's not feeling pressure in the same way in like the second set.
Sure.
He's just not. But this is where you really get to see what's your level of commitment. What are you doing here? And, you know, if he had gone for kind of the wrong serve and stayed back and, you know, taken something off his ball and played conservative,
passively.
Yeah, that's where you say, okay, you still don't understand what you really need to do to win. He didn't do that. He kept coming forward. He gets out of that love 30, gets back to 30 all, gets back to deuce, gets himself obviously out of that game and wins the match. But, I mean, I literally didn't know what was going to happen until love 30. And then those 2 points, when it was 30 all, in my mind, it was done. Roger knew what he needed to do. He was going to do it. And barring Nadal just coming up with something absolutely outrageous,
which he's capable of doing. But
which he's capable of doing, but I still think Roger's in control at that moment, and I think it proved out that way. The only thing that I really could have seen Roger doing would have been a throwback to, say, what Tommy Haas almost pulled off on the clay against Federer, or what Djokovic did pull off when he just tanked a forehand and hit a cross-court return off of a first serve.
Right.
And Rafa's not going to tank like that. So,
sure.
You know, that's just not his mentality. He's not Novak.
Right.
And so I think we knew better than to expect that for him. I think we knew how Rafa was going to play it. The question was going to be if Fed's going to play it the right way. And still, I mean, he's only got to miss by a few centimeters.
Right. See, but the funny thing is I completely disagree, and this is going to probably sound funny to some people, but I think the critical moment for Federer actually happened in the second set. Which mm-hmm. is the set that one of the two sets that he lost.
I know where you're going here. Yeah.
You know, and this to me is the critical thing. You know, he goes down a break, you know, all well and good, goes down a second break. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is the moment when you talk about in the fifth set, not knowing whether or not he was going to, you know, stay true to the game plan and be committed. To me, mm-hmm. like at that point, I knew there was no question whether or not he's going to be committed at that point, because the moment when he was going to abandon it, to me, was when he went down two breaks in that second set. That was the time when I thought, if he's going to panic and ditch the game plan, it's going to be now. And
right.
He didn't. He stayed true to it. He kept staying aggressive. He kept hitting over the backhand return, pressing forward, dictating play with the forehand. Gets one break back. And even though the thing to me was, even though we ended up losing that set, and you know it was only by the one break, the fact that he stayed with his game plan.
He needed that. Yeah.
He needed that. And he broke back and then held out the rest of that set. Playing that way set the tone for him to keep playing that way for the rest of the match, because it showed to me that he knew this is what he had to do to win. And even if it's not working right now, I know it's the right play. In the past, we haven't seen that from him against Rafa. We've seen him come out and play some phenomenal first sets. I mean, I remember a 6-1 set on clay at Roland Garros in the finals of the French Open. He came out
right.
and laid a breadstick on Rafa.
Yeah.
At his own house.
On dirt.
Right. But then lost the match. Lost the next three sets straight, and for similar kind of reasons. One bad game, and then he starts backing off, and then before you know it, it's just not the same player anymore. And when he showed me that conviction in the second set down two breaks, I thought, this break right here, that's going to set the tone for the rest of the match for him, even if he doesn't win this set. And that turned out to be the case.
And this is what I think is different about Federer now. And just for the people that are listening out there, I will verify, you actually sent me a message when he was down two breaks and said, if Federer doesn't get one of these breaks back, he's probably cooked. But if he gets one back, I feel fine about this. And, you know, so and that makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I think you're spot on there. When it comes to the mentality and the commitment and what I think of as the understanding of what you really need to do, I think that if you look back on Federer's career or the career of any player where they've had a matchup problem, right? You have to figure out, how do I need to play this? What are the appropriate tactics for this guy or for this situation or for this match? Federer, to me, in the past was basically trying things out. He wasn't committed with a real understanding of how he needed to approach the matchup against Rafa.
Sure.
And, you know, it's on the one hand, I mean, let's not pretend like we're like any of us are going to touch any of the records that Federer has set, right? There's a respect there that you just cannot question. But at the same time, it's our job to understand what's going on, not to, you know, actually be on the show in the Aussie Open finals and do it and execute it. And, you know, if you tell a player on the tour, look, like, your play and your behavior betrays your thought process here, they kind of understand it, even if they're trying really hard to commit to something. But we've seen it time and time again. I mean, every time that Rafa really punched back at Federer, he would back off and
sure.
he'd slip into the same style of play. And you've been, you know, talking about it for years and writing about
right.
it
There's
for years.
That comfort level. Well, look, this works against everybody else. And I think the part of the problem for Fed was, I mean, obviously, you know, the head-to-head doesn't flatter Federer very much. But the flip side of that is, I mean, he wins roughly one-third of the matches between the two of them.
Right.
I mean, there's kind of that sense, well, he won enough playing his normal
yeah,
game.
Exactly.
That he almost kind of felt like, well, I'll just keep doing this and I'm going to win enough. I'm not going to win them all, but,
well,
you know,
I think my time will come. Even more than that, the psychology, I think, is more powerful here, because we see it, and this will come up when we talk about other matchups and other players and other tactics. When you win a third of the matches, it's that result actually validates your thinking.
Right.
And it encourages you to think, I need to do the same thing, but maybe a little bit better. And this is what Dimitrov's going to be thinking. Hey, I was 1 point away, you know?
Well, I don't think that he's wrong necessarily. I mean, I really actually like the way that Dimitrov came out. And you and I may disagree on this, but I like the way Dimitrov came out and attacked Nadal. I like the way he played him a little bit more vertically.
I like the way that he attacks him. I love Dimitrov's movement at the net because he's scary athletic. He moves scary fast in certain situations that are really hard to quantify. And, you know, I don't think he gets enough credit for that. But, I mean, come on. You know how good Dimitrov's backhand is. It's at least as good as Federer's. He's not making the same choices with it. Like, I think Dimitrov can hit lasers cross court and it's going to be really, really effective. But I don't think he practices that. I think he practices more straightforward, more, you know, of a linear shot, more down the line balls. And I think in his mind, he thinks, you know, I'm going to spank this guy down the line and that's going to be my advantage. And
yeah,
I just don't think that that's as good of a tactic as what we saw Federer do.
I don't see, but that's the thing. I like when I watched Dimitrov play Nadal, like I consistently saw him use the backhand, cross court to set up the down-the-line ball and finish on down-the-line balls. Like we saw him do it over and over again. I think it was a good play for him.
Finish on cross-court balls.
Yeah, but I think that – but here's the difference to me is that I think that, especially given their history, that Rafa – was committed to getting forehands, and especially on the big points. And we saw this in the fifth set. This is part of the reason why Fed was able to hit eight backhand winners, and so many of them being cross-court backhand winners and ground-stroke rallies, was that Rafa knew, and there's that, we talk about comfort zones. For Rafa, the comfort zone against Fed is to run around every backhand possible, hit high, heavy balls to Federer's backhand, and just stay on it until he misses. And he tried to do that on big points, and Fed hit cross-court forehand backhands, caught Rafa two or three steps out of position, and just smacked winners on him. You know, I don't think that Rafa had quite the same commitment to trying to create forehands to himself against Dimitrov. I think there wasn't quite the same fear that he had of Fed. I mean, for all that we talk about Federer's fear of Nadal, Nadal has to fear Federer some too. Because this guy...
everybody.
Well, of course Nadal fears everybody, but Nadal also has a 97% win record against most everybody else on tour. You know, he has a 66% win record, and I'm rounding this, right? But, I mean, he has roughly a 2-3 win record against Federer. This guy, you know, Federer has given him more trouble than almost anybody else on tour. For all that we talk about, oh, he owns him in the head-to-head, I say rubbish overall. Nadal, of all people, better than anybody, understands the threat that Federer poses.
Yes,
how many people
sure.
have put Nadal, or how many people have dropped the bagel on Nadal since he turned professional? Is there even three? I'm not sure there is. I have a sneaking suspicion that Federer might be literally the only person to ever bagel Nadal since he turned professional.
I'll have to message Sharker on that one.
Maybe somebody can correct me on that. But I you know, my gut feeling is Federer's the only person to do it, and he's done it more than once. You know, I think there's a fear there for Nadal as well. Not like not a fear to the degree where it's like, oh God, I'm scared to go out and play this guy. I'm going to change the way that I play. But more a fear of, God, I know what I have to do, and if I don't do this well, I'm going to lose. And mm-hmm. and the do this well thing typically comes down to making forehands, getting them high to Fed's backhand, and just getting that short ball and then punishing him. And, you know, against Dimitrov, I think he just wasn't quite as committed to doing that, and didn't, you know, he ended up playing better court position against Dimitrov than he did against Federer because there wasn't that history there. And I think maybe because he also feared Dimitrov's backhand a little bit more, rightly or wrongly. You know, and there we have it. But I think the other big thing that I really want to talk about before we wrap up here is the fact that, and this was the other thing that I think was just a massive turnaround, wasn't just the backhand winners that Federer hit, was the fact that when we look at the fifth set, and I think about almost every single major point that was a long rally, mm-hmm. right, Federer won them. And traditionally the idea was, and we've seen this play out, was the longer the rally went, the more likely Nadal was to win it. And that went double for points, and you know, in this match, it was the reverse.
But, you know, that's interesting. And we haven't actually talked about this topic, but I've got to give I'm giving a shout out to Craig O'Shansi here again. I don't think that matters very much. I really don't. I think if you look at, and I don't have these stats, I didn't run them during the match.
Right.
But
I know what you're going to say about the whole first ball, you know, winning the short rallies, the 0-4.
He won the short rallies, yeah.
No, I get that as a whole. I don't deny that, right? But one of the big points of differentiation between the two of them has always been the fact that I think Nadal has dominated the long rallies and sought to create them to a degree. And this is the first time, and I think it just speaks volumes about where Federer was at when he played this match and mentally. This is the first time I can remember where when the rally was long, Federer didn't just hang in there. Fed was the one finishing with a winner in the fifth set when he was supposed to be the guy who was tired and shanking backhands. Instead, he's cracking cross-court winners. And I think it just is a massive shift in the dynamic between these two players. Massive shift. Whatever we can talk about, I think at the end of the day, one of the other things that O'Shaughnessy would probably freely admit is how fine the margins are at the top of the sport.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Right.
They're tiny.
When we look about statistically, you know, if you win 55% of the points in a set, you're like 98, 99% sure to win the set, right? When we look at from that perspective, those handful of long rallies that Federer did win made the match for him. We're used to him winning short points. I mean, his serve plus one has been, you know, God, paying his grandchildren's college education for, you know, 20 years now almost. Let's be real. So that's not a surprise. It's not a surprise that he won a lot of the short points. The difference maker in this match, especially in the fifth set, was those long. If he loses even two more of those long rallies, we're having a very different podcast right now.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the argument that I think most of the coaches make against what O'Shaughnessy says, is that like those 3 or 4 really long rallies were pivotal and
No, they
changed the
were. Look,
match and everything.
O'Shaughnessy's right. Let's just cut right through this one. O'Shaughnessy is right. You have to be effective in your serve plus one, return plus one. Big tennis matches are all about, those first four balls. But the point is, you have to win those rallies. You have to be effective at those rallies. You have to practice those patterns in order to put yourself in the situation that Federer did to be able to win that match. If Fed doesn't do those things well, it doesn't make a difference if he wins those long rallies, because at the end of the day, he's not even going to be in a fifth set with Nadal. The point is, he did all those things well. The difference maker was,
And he
and
won them.
likewise, yeah, and this has been the difference maker in their past meetings, I think, especially when it gets to the fifth set, is in the past, he's won a lot of those short rallies, but the swing category between these two guys has been the longer rallies that have worn Fed down, have taken his legs out from under him, and also, I think, just fatigued his back
Oh,
end.
okay. So I've got to say bollocks,
Okay,
because
say bollocks away.
I think you're selling yourself short here. I think you make an interesting point about the long rallies, but I really think that the whole match turned on Federer's tactics, on playing the way that, you, as I'm sure there are other people out there, have been close at least to saying, he needs to play more this way. But the way that Federer attacked, the way that he moved forward, the way that he was trying to spread the court even from the ground, right? And all of those things combine to kind of leave the statistics in a place where they're a little bit harder to read, okay? For instance, Fed wins 76% of points on his first serve. That's pretty standard for him. He'd actually
It's a
like to be
little low
higher.
for him,
Yeah, he'd like to
actually.
be up at 80, right? But on second serve, do you know what he won?
I know it was well above 50% comfortably, wasn't it? Or 49.
40,
49.
49, under 50%,
That's still
which
high for him against Rafa, though.
usually that means he's losing a match, though. So,
No, not for Fed. Not for
yeah.
Fed. No, not 49%. On second serves, no. Not against Rafa. I gotta say no on that one.
Mate, I'm saying call Craig O'Shaughnessy on this one. He's the one who's got more data than anybody else, and this is where I'm getting it from. So, but more importantly, even if I were off by a couple of percentage points there, which is totally possible, right? The important part is the style of play allows him, instead of to be very steady and consistent and say minimize errors, which is something that he's tried to do most of the time. Instead, the style of play allows him to group points together in a way that he can open up big advantages. And that's what makes the difference in the match.
Sure. And I mean, in a sense, it's kind of like Misha Zverev with the commitment to the serve and volley and attack the net. It's like, look, I'm not, I mean, look, in that match, Zverev won 55% of the net points, which is a phenomenally low number. But when you look at the sheer volume of times that he went to the net, that ends up being a lot of points. So that 5% difference is actually a really positive thing. And I get what you're saying, and I don't disagree. I guess part of this also comes down to the fact that by being aggressive, by stepping up in the court, by driving the backhand cross court, we get a very interesting number, which is the distance covered. And when we look at that, Federer 11.1 to Nadal's 11.4, right, meters per point. And when we look at the overall match, Fed ran a little over 3 kilometers, 3.2 kilometers, and Nadal's 3.306. Point being that what we see is Federer shortening points. We see Federer dictating play more. We see a lot less of Federer scrambling. We see a lot less of Federer pinned in his own backhand corner, hitting balls above the shoulder, trying to, he looked like a man, we'll go back to some of these French Opens.
Yeah.
He looked like a man who was drowning and clutching for a lifesaver. And in this match, we didn't see that. We didn't see him get just worn down, like beat down by that high ball with Nadal just grinding away at him and just wearing him down. That dynamic was gone, and I think that played a huge part in why in the fifth set he was able to not just stand toe to toe with Nadal in the long rallies, but be the one who came out ahead because he's always had the firepower. It's never been a question of that. It's whether or not he was in a position in the fifth set to be able to be balanced and there to execute with that firepower on a ball that's as heavy as Nadal's and as well struck as Nadal's. And traditionally, the answer to that has been no. He's always been tired. He's been a little winded. His legs have been a little bit gone. His shoulder's been a little bit gone. And so he's a half step out of position. You know, he's opening the hips and the shoulders up a little bit to try to get that little bit extra power on the back end. And in doing so, compromise the stroke integrity.
And all of everything that you're saying, all of that goes back to the tactics that he used.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
It's all right. And the point is he saved a lot of energy. He saved himself from digging out of a lot of corners, from a lot of big power moves is the way that I call him in the gym. You know, things that are going to gas him over the long haul, and instead use that to move forward. And that's ultimately sustainable for him.
Use that to just stand and deliver off the backhand side. You know? I mean, he was able to keep his core together. He's able to keep his shoulders and hips closed long enough in the stroke to just drive the bejesus out of that ball. And we saw the result. So, obviously, congratulations to Roger. 18 Grand Slams. I thought that both of them had
congratulations to Glenn Hill for actually making the right call.
Yeah, well, but I thought they both handled the post-press conference very well, even up on the podiums. I think they both obviously handled sort of the dignity and grace that we're used to from two great champions. I can't wait to see what the rest of this year holds. I think it's going to be a very fascinating year. And I think potentially the most exciting year that I can remember in men's professional tennis, because there's just so many incredible storylines ahead of us. We've got so many great young players coming up. You know, Goffin, you've Dimitrov, Zverev, you know, Rionic obviously is up. I can't really say he's coming up. But then we look at this, I don't know if this was the match that tennis needed or deserved or quite how to phrase this, but I do think it was a magical outcome. Not just that Federer won, because, you know, I think either of these great champions winning would have been great for the game, but just the fact that they were there.
Get there and to get through. I mean, Federer's never beaten more seeds getting through.
Oh, and 3 5-set matches in a single slam.
Yeah.
You know, could point that as well. But the thing to me is it wasn't just that these guys got there. It was the fact that they played such incredibly high-quality, entertaining tennis and did it with a sense of dignity and grace. And you see the friendship at the end. You see the respect they have for each other. And I think when we look at that, plus all these other storylines about, you know, Djokovic and his, you know, current kind of slump, and just there's so much drama to be had. So,
all the guys coming up are really, really raising the level. Murray is still there. I mean, that was a blip. So, I mean, Murray's going to be interjected back in. Federer and Nadal, it feels like, are back at a new level. I mean, all of a sudden, Rafa is probably the favorite in Paris.
Right.
Murray's going to be right there. Novak seems to be slipping, but we don't really know what's going on with him. Zverev played an unbelievable match against Nadal. And then, you know, guys like Dominic Thiem are still getting better. And then there are even younger guys coming up the pipeline. I mean, the level of tennis is just improving, improving, improving. And it's pretty cool to see guys like Federer make adjustments and show, well, hey, you know, I'm going to change my tactics and be able to come out on top here and really be in this conversation for as long as possible.
Right.
I don't think there's never been a time in tennis where you have this many quality players playing at this kind of a level. I mean, it's just never existed.
No.
So,
and also, I mean, the other thing that's fascinating to me is, like, we've never had a time in tennis where you've had two great champions like Rafa and Fed. You know, I mean, if we liken them to, let's say, Agassi and Sampras, you know, both those guys, I mean, obviously Agassi kind of kept playing a little bit longer, but I mean, you know, like Sampras won that last US Open and just disappeared, you know.
Yeah, I don't see Fed quitting this year.
No, I don't see him quitting. But I think my point here is that we've got this great rivalry, and it's still going. It's going 5 years after people thought it might be done, and it's still taking place. And at the same time, we've got that layer, and then we've got this slightly younger layer where you've got, you know, your Djokovic and your Murray, and then you've got this younger layer where you've got these guys in their mid-20s that are starting to find their games. You know, we've got Dimitrov,
Rionic,
and then you've got this younger layer, which is, you know, your Thiem and Zverev, which is like these guys that are 19 to 21. So you've got almost like these four micro-generations
Yeah.
All overlapping. You know, it's phenomenal. It's just absolutely phenomenal. And so it's going to be a great year. Excited to share it with everybody out there. Once again, if you have any questions, comments, please do reach out to us, Glenn@tactical.tennis, Jacob@tactical.tennis. You can follow us on Facebook. We're on iTunes with the podcast, and obviously the website at tacticaltennis.com. So I guess we'll wrap up there. We'll talk to you all very soon. Clay court season coming up in a little while, and lots to come.
Plenty to talk about. Cheers,
all right,
mate.
All right. Goodbye, everybody.